Hello, everyone. Welcome to this evening's event to launch and discuss Silver Anne Hewlett's book, Baby Hunger. I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm the director of the IPPR, and I'm standing in this awkward position because there's a platform here because...
Should we can move it, Matthew?
No, it's fine. It's fine. Yes, let's move it. Okay. I'm only going to speak for a couple of minutes, and then Silver Anne Hewlett's going to talk for a little longer about the book, and then I'm delighted to say that Tessa Zhao, Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, will be responding to some of the things that Sylvia Anne will be saying, and then we'll be turning it over. Then there'll be a little bit of a discussion between us, just for a few minutes, and then I'll bring you in. And we'll go for it till about 8:15, I think. Now, I've been told to tell you a number of specific things. Sylvia Anne will be signing the book after... we've had our discussion here, so if you want the book signed, come up and get it signed. Secondly, there's a reception after this event on the fifth floor in a room called, it says called the Common Room. I think it is the Common Room. So on the fifth floor, Common Room, for a splendid reception afterwards. I'm only going to say a couple of things before we begin, and I'm mainly going to say them because I'm quite irritated. I want to go back a year to when Robert Putnam, the internationally acclaimed sociologist, was here, and he was launching his book Bowling Alone. And I did a number of events with Putnam. And at the end of it, I said, what's it like launching your book in Britain? And he said, well, it's great. Everyone's very nice to me. But the really strange thing, he says, is that every single question I've been asked in all the events I've been to have been about things that I didn't actually say in the book. And this is a bit strange, really. And a few questions about things which I do say in the book and which I deal with in the book, but as if I haven't said them in the book. And this culminated in an event, I never forget it, at the NCVO, when Robert spoke for 45 minutes, did a brilliant presentation, and the next speaker was unable to give their address because they based their address on an account of Robert's work they read in The Guardian, but it didn't apply. So it was all rather embarrassing, and they had to speak from the top of the head. Now, I was thinking of this the other day when I looked at some of and much of the reaction to the book has been, to Baby Hunger, has been positive, but some of the reaction, which is, it seems to me, quite deliberately sought to mislead people about the contents of the book. The book, which I think is splendid, does not say that it is unnatural for women not to have children. The book does not criticise women for seeking to have it all. The book does not blame everything on women and let men off the hook, to quote some of the charges that have been labelled, addressed at the book. I was reading... one review, if that is a word that you could apply to it, by someone who I actually think you were sparring with this morning on the radio, who refers to the people that you speak to in your book, and I use the quotes here, as heartbroken, infertile spinsters. I think that's the level of... that really tells you more about the contempt that Christina Adoni has for other women than it does for anything that's in your book, I have to say. I think this book is excellent because, like all good social analysis, it makes you think about society, but it also makes you think about yourself and your own relationship to society. It's important because it makes us think about our own priorities, and it is important because it makes us think about how society shapes those priorities. It has important policy implications. It is a non-judgmental book. In terms of how people have lived their lives, but it is judgmental in terms of the way in which those lives are framed by public policy and corporate practice. I have my own issues with the book, not criticism. I think it's useful to criticise a book which has added so much to our thinking, but I have my own issues. I'm publishing a book at the beginning of next year, written with my father, about which is called What Are Children For? Which argues rather more broadly that the whole activity of having children and having long-term relationships seems to be increasingly somehow countercultural in the modern world. And I would set some of the issues in that broader context, but maybe that's something we can return to in the discussion we're going to have. So with no further ado, I'm delighted to welcome to the RAISE platform, Silvia Anne Hewlett.
I always think that speakers are meant to have such long legs, so... do excuse all the shuffling around back here. It's such an amazing pleasure this evening to be here and look out at an audience where there are some very long-time friends and my sister Ruth. Thank you for coming. I also very much want to thank the team at Atlantic Books, particularly Toby Mundy and Fiona McMorrow, who have launched this book, I think, with almost magical effect. I'm also deeply grateful to Matthew Taylor for chairing this evening's event, not just because of his generous words of support, but because of his leadership of IPPR, which I think is perhaps one of the most important think tanks in Europe in terms of imaginative social analysis and policy making. I worked there for a short time in the early 90s as a colleague of Patricia Hewitt, and for a decade I've been very proud of at least having a small connection with this amazing place. But most of all, I want to thank Tessa Jowell. She is one of my political heroes for two reasons. One is that she's actually pushed the frontier a little. She's created some policies that have made it more possible for more grown-ups to really do both things. But I think on a very personal level, she's also given us all permission to cherish and celebrate our families, because she has chosen to wear it on her sleeve and reminded us that there are firm boundaries between life and work, and sometimes life needs to come first. Let me begin the main part of this evening by telling the story of how this book got started. Some 5 years ago, I set off to celebrate the lives of the breakthrough generation of women. That's the phrase I use to describe that amazing cohort of women who came of age in the 1970s, broke through all those glass ceilings, and took a much deserved place in worlds previously reserved for men. And as I went into those interviews, I remember thinking through the themes that I was going to focus on, and they were themes really geared to career. I was fascinated by their strategies of success, really interested in whether they had owed much to feminism in an explicit way, and whether they had lent on mentors, the usual kinds of questions. But after 15 interviews, I remember looking at my notes and realizing that none of these women had children. Now, I hadn't picked them because they didn't have children. I'd merely sought out very prominent women in a whole variety of fields. So I went back for a second round of interviews and asked the obvious question, which was, did you mean not to have children? Was this a choice? And if it wasn't, what had gotten in the way? And what I heard was not the story of having sat down at 28 and kind of snapped your fingers and said, you know, what I want is this big career, I'm not interested in family. That is not what I heard. What I heard were tales of children being pushed to the margins of life. One called it a creeping non-choice. Another woman said she felt robbed of choice. And that started me on a quest to try and find out whether these lives were typical of a much bigger range of women. And what I did then was step back and fund, I raised the money to start a whole new kind of national project where I looked at what had happened to the top 10% of women, everyone earning over $55,000 a year in the States. And that is some of the, you know, basic framework of this book. But before going into the data, let me give you some of the voices from this book, because in some ways it is the very powerful stories, which are both inspirational as well as being very poignant, that really, I think, broke the silence around this topic, at least in the States. A woman, her name is Tamara Adler, a very senior woman at Deutsche Bank when I interviewed her. In fact, she was voted one of the 10 most powerful women in the City of London. When I talked to Tamara, she was, you know, one of the many very impressive women I talked to. She wanted to reflect on what had gone wrong in her life on this front. She spent 11 years working for Goldman Sachs, working a 70-hour week, traveling a great deal. And when she turned around in her late 30s to spend some time and attention on finding the loving partner, dealing with the family agenda, she felt it had slipped her by. And part of the reason was the continuing asymmetry between men and women in terms of relationships. And her language was amazing. She said, you know, in high-altitude careers, where the air is thin and it's difficult to breathe, you need oxygen. And men find it so much easier to find oxygen than women. And what she was talking about was the fact that for a high-earning, successful man, there were a whole bevy of perhaps less ambitious, perhaps younger women who were thrilled to pieces to fix them a drink, rub their back, make their dinner, whatever. And yet for women, that kind of man seemed a little thin on the ground. Another voice from the book, an amazing scholar at Ohio State University. Her name is Stella Parsons. She thought she'd done a lot of planning. She did get married in her 30s, but she and her husband were moving around in this peripatetic academic game, you know, 2 years at Santa Cruz, a year at Boston College, and then you're off to Vanderbilt. So they didn't get round to thinking about children until she was 37. She then had three miscarriages, took out a second mortgage, did three rounds of IVF, and ended up at 43, still childless. And she said, you know, I've even begun to resent my sexual organs, because if these big breasts and bloody periods end up being totally useless, how can I do anything else but see them as burdensome? And what I found in these interviews, as well as in this huge survey I did, is that these women were very fierce in their advice to younger women, because they did not want succeeding generations not to have richer choices in their lives. And I find that a profoundly feminist sensibility. But let's back up for a second and look at the data, because it is rather startling. It shows that 42% of women in corporate America, for instance, are childless at age 40. And only a tiny percentage of them saw it as a choice. What I find in the data is that about 14% of women right across the board will choose not to have children, and that is a very honorable choice these days. It's the other 86% I worry about. Because the fact is, we've got a mirror image going on between men and women. The more successful you are as a woman, the more you earn, the more likely it is you're on your own. The reverse is true for men. The more you earn, the more successful you are, the more likely it is you've had all kinds of wives and all kinds of children. One of the examples I use in my book is siblings, Wendy Wasserstein, the playwright, and her brother, Bruce Wasserstein. Well, Wendy is, I think, a much beloved, famous person in New York, and when she got that child under the wire at age 48, everyone applauded, because we knew it had been a 10-year struggle. She had tried IVF 7 times, and she was dealing with a very premature child. But she had no partner, and it clearly was a case where she had gone to the ends of the world to get that baby. Her brother, on the other hand, Bruce Wasserstein, a very successful investment banker, has had, I thought, 2 wives and 5 children, no problem. But on this book tour, when I was in Boston, a woman called in on a talk radio show and said, you know, I love the story about the Wassersteins, but you know, he was married 3 times and I was wife number one. Somehow it had been eliminated from his official bio, but it kind of made my point a little more strongly, I think. I found, again, in the data that there were 2 pieces of news which were particularly compelling. First of all, I had imagined the conditions were better for younger women. I looked at 2 age groups in the survey, the 40 to 55-year-olds, which was the breakthrough generation, but then I also looked at 28 to 40-year-olds, expecting to find that circumstances had become somewhat easier for them in terms of balancing their lives. Not true. In fact, the data show that things are worse. The reason I thought they might be better is, of course, that there are more women in the professions, we feel that attitudes have changed, etc. But it turns out that for the younger women, fully 55% of them don't have kids and a career together at age 35, which is a bigger number than was true of the current set of 50-year-olds at that age. And when I went to interview these younger women, I found that two things were creating even bigger obstacles in their lives. Fact number one, they are responding and dealing with truly brutal work pressures. A third of them were working 20 hours more a week than their older sisters were at the same stages in their careers. And it was, I think, an enormous hurdle for them because they couldn't quite see how they could grow themselves a life, sustain a relationship, or have kids. If you're working 70 hours a week, it's real hard. But the other thing which was true of this group is that they had swallowed the myth that it was really easy to have kids in your 40s, and they were relying on it. 90% of them thought that that was absolutely possible these days, and they felt it was therefore fine to postpone the family agenda until much later. And as we all know, that simply is not true. And at least in the States, part of the reason why we've had all of the hype around the miracle babies and very little in the way of real information as to what the odds and the risks are is not just Hollywood. I mean, we all know that People magazine runs endless cover stories about how many, you know, Hollywood mothers managed to do it quite readily at 46 or 48. It's also a fact of life that the infertility industry in America is profit-driven, and in a way, they love to have a whole queue of 42-year-olds, you know, queuing up to do IVF seven times because it's good for the bottom line. It's good for business. Middle-aged women often have deep pockets. And so there is, I think, a rather cynical exploitation of a huge set of needs and even the almost desperation that exists on this front. But again, I think knowledge can be very powerful in informing smarter choices on this front. One of the women in the book, age 42, gotten married just 2 years ago, and she said that one of the first things she and her husband did was run around the corner to the local IVF clinic to, you know, get going with the high-tech stuff. She said, we were lucky. We met a doctor who told us the truth. He looked at us and said, you know, your chances are 3%. If I were you, I wouldn't go there. If you want a child, you might want to consider the adoption route. And she says, in a way, that was the hardest day of my life. But it was enormously constructive because this particular couple, you know, did then make the choice to adopt a child and, in fact, had decided that, you know, motherhood was about parenting and not just about pregnancy. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that at all ages and perhaps in very many contexts, women can make smarter choices about their bodies, about their bosses, if they do know their real options are and are in touch with the facts. Let me just back up a moment and say something about how we got to this place and also talk very, vigorously about some of the policy context here, because this is not just a group of individual decisions. As Matthew very, accurately said, it's in a context of a structure and a set of conditions that make it incredibly hard to do both things. And let me just back up for a moment and talk about the big context. There are only three nations in the world which have very high rates of childlessness. They are America, Britain, and Australia. Now, there are lots of countries out there that have low birth rates, countries like Spain, countries like Russia, countries like Japan. We all know that low birth rates are, you know, the new reality in many parts of the world. But, for instance, in Spain, it's much more a question of 90% of women having very small families, not the fact that all kinds of Spanish women don't have children. In fact, the childlessness rate in Spain is just 11%. Which is almost precisely the number of women who don't want children. But the countries that I pinpointed just now, the UK, the US, and Australia have extremely high rates of childlessness, particularly amongst educated women. Because in these countries, we've created a set of conditions which make the trade-offs between family and work particularly sharp, particularly deep. And I think the experience of other countries shows that it need not be so. What do those three countries share? I mean, what produces the conditions that creates such difficult realities for women? Well, first off, these women, these countries, have a very kind of market-driven employment pattern, with long work weeks being, a central reality of modern lives. In fact, those three countries have the longest working hours, the least vacation, all, you can fill in the blanks. So that's condition number one. Condition number two, up until at least very recently, these countries provided very weak family supports. I think the Labour government is making some very fast progress in this direction, but up until very recently, the UK certainly had the worst childcare in Europe, and maternity leave probably was less good than elsewhere. Just some examples of what we know has happened. Thirdly, these countries experienced a women's movement which emphasized equal rights almost exclusively, unlike Sweden, unlike even France. And whereas equal rights are enormously important, they only get us halfway there. Because fundamentally, women's family stories remain very different from men. So if you want equal results for women, which is what I want, you need equal rights plus a supportive policy context, both in the private sector and in government. And finally, what these countries share is a terribly traditional division of labor at home. If you look at the recent surveys in this country, there's been some done by the insurance companies, women continue to pick up about 75-80% of childcare and housework. And as a result, there's this double load going on, which makes it very hard to create the balance in life that most women want. Now, those four characteristics are a pernicious mix, I think, for all grown-ups, but particularly for women. And I guess what I'm saying is that when we struggle with our individual choices, we have to really understand that it's not our personal fault, our personal failure, if we don't pull off this small miracle of the balancing act, because the overall structure, the overall context, makes it truly difficult. And one of the unfortunate results of this struggle in both the UK and the US, which goes back to Matthew's point, is that women, I think, wrestling with disappointment, either in the career or in the family, tend to blame each other rather than the framework or the structure, which is why I think in the workplace, women with children have a whole agenda vis-a-vis women without children in the workplace. And we all know that mothers at home and mothers at work, again, find ways in which they kind of blame one another for their predicament. And I think one of the core thrusts of this book is that we need to come together and understand that if we want richer choices for our daughters, more generous choices for our daughters, we have to move on both fronts. Yes, there is something that can be done in individual decision making, but even more importantly, we need to push the agenda both in the private sector and in government. Let me just circle around for a minute and talk very personally about what I feel has been the trajectory of some of this this weighted decision making over the last generation. 30 years ago, something great and glorious happened in the lives of women. Enormous opportunities did open up. And in a way, my own life is a very good example. I grew up in the Welsh mining valleys in a home with five sisters. where there was no refrigerator or telephone, but there was a great deal of parental attention. The community had an unemployment rate which hovered at the 23% level when I was a teenager. And in a previous era, perhaps we could look forward to marrying an unemployed minor or working in Woolworths. But when I was 13, my father took me by bus to Cambridge University. And he showed me its ethereal beauty. And he said, you know, this place is beginning to open its doors a little wider to women. It's also true that a Labour government was in power, and they were leaning over backwards to take ill-prepared students from state schools, which was me. And it changed my life, that ambition. I did indeed go to Cambridge, and I ended up subsequently going to Harvard and earning a degree in a PhD in economics, and ending up in one of those elite professions, along with many of the women in this book. So I do understand how powerful these opportunities have been for these generations of modern women. But you know, we created an amazing set of opportunities, but the societal and the domestic logic and framework remain precisely the same. So the tensions and the collisions in women's lives, at least in the three countries I'm talking about, have become intense. And unless we do something, I think they're going to get even worse for subsequent cohorts of women, precisely because we have this brutal career structure with the long hours and the seeming inability to balance our lives remotely early on. Let me end with a note about men, and it's particularly wonderful to see at least some gender balance in the audience. One of the policy challenges is not just getting the right stuff on the book, and I particularly want to commend Tessa for the Work-Life Balance Fund that she created, which is, I think, creating incentives for the private sector to actually move on this front, and it's just an example of the kind of measure which is very much there in the new government. We've also got to change attitudes and culture, and again, a story. And it's very pertinent because I know that the UK is about to get paid parenting leave next year. 3 years ago, I took it upon myself to do a little research in terms of what kind of difference it made to men in terms of their fathering, I guess, ambitions, fatherhood ambitions, if they had real contact at the beginning of life. I wanted to see what kind of difference paternity leave made. Because at the beginning of the Clinton era, as you might remember, he did create something called unpaid parenting leave, which was available to both sexes. So there are a whole bunch of men out there who were entitled to it. I went to do my research at the Ford Foundation. The reason I chose the Ford Foundation is that there were 600 employees. It was one of these, you know, bleeding liberal heart kind of organizations. And I knew that the Ford Foundation probably had exemplary parenting leave policies. Well, sure enough, they had paid paternity leave for 32 years at the Ford Foundation. The only problem is no man had ever taken it. Now, I went to interview some of these wonderful young fathers. They were very much new fathers. They ran around with snugglies at the weekend and, you know, tried to do the right thing. And one of them stood on one leg and tried to explain why he hadn't taken something that was on the books. And he said, you know, there's this written book out there, but there's also an unwritten code that we really pay attention to. And the message in the unwritten code is that taking paternity leave in this city is a little like having lace on your jockey shorts. Good, upstanding, you know, red-blooded American professionals don't do things like this. And I think that that goes to the heart of the true challenge in front of us, because it's not merely a question of getting things on the book. It's making them legitimate, making the Anglo-American world understand that having a child isn't just some kind of expensive private hobby, but it's something of profound societal and civic significance. And we need to create a nation where grown-ups can choose to do this if they want, and a context in which they could do it well. Thank you.
That's absolutely fantastic. I'm going to make a confession now before I turn to Tessa Jowell, which is about a year ago I was chairing a National Daycare Trust conference about family-friendly working. And I'm always supposed to take the children to school on Monday, Tuesdays and Wednesdays. It was a Tuesday morning. I had to be there at 9 o'clock. So as I rushed out of the house at 8:15, leaving my partner to take the children to school, breaking my rules, she said, "Oh, you've got to go to this conference. What's the conference about?" And she still thinks it was about the National Rail strategy. So I've confessed now. Tessa.
Do you want the platform or not, Tessa?
I think I could do this platform as well.
Yes, okay. Thank you very much indeed.
No, that's all. I feel very high up, but that's absolutely fine. Well, I thought that was absolutely fantastic, Sylviane, and I was just when Matthew, I'm not quite sure what I signed up to this evening, but whatever it was, I said yes. And I've had a day of negotiating the National Football Stadium, the communications bill, and just come from the women's rugby team reception to send them off to their World Cup bid in Barcelona. So this was fantastic, but I just hope that with all the other distractions that I've had today, that I can offer you something by way of response that is worthy of the fantastic analysis that Sylviane has given us and is coherent. Let me just offer you a few probably slightly disconnected reflections on why we are where we are in relation to this. And you know, I'm slightly hampered by the fact that I don't know what the UK data are to match with the US data, but I think that all of us here will have recognized the similarity in the narrative that we've just heard. And I think that if we look at the sort of obsessions that define our society, the whole thing about youth and the value put on youth is part of that. And so this sense of, you know, the sense that, you know, your fertility is something which is finite is somehow linked to a denial of getting older, you know, as is, I think, the huge increase in cosmetic surgery, invasive or non-invasive, and hugely expensive face creams that promise that they will sort of polish away the map that your previous life has etched on your face. So I think that is part of it. But I suppose my question and what I really want to begin with is what I think is a very interesting dilemma for the women's movement. When, you know, if you think back to the late 60s, early 70s, where so much of the focus of the energy and purpose of the women's movement was on controlling fertility. And what Sylviane is describing to us is the converse of that. It is the sort of reclamation of lost fertility or compromised fertility. So I think that that is sort of quite an interesting dilemma that you've thrown up. But I suppose my second, and perhaps the question that I'd like to speak to just for a few minutes, is, you know, what is the public policy response to the consequence of these private choices, which then become the cause of so much private grief. And I'd like just to say a little bit about that. First of all, I think that, you know, sometimes there's an attempt in benign public policy to, in response to Matthew's question, what are children for, to provide a rather sort of utilitarian view of what children are for. you know, we've all seen these figures that show how the carer or the dependent taxpayer ratio is beginning to fall. Therefore, you know, when all of us get dependent in our late 80s, I don't intend to get dependent before my late 80s, get dependent, you know, God willing, in our late 80s, if we don't have plenty of children, there won't be enough people to look after us. But I think it's the public policy response is, in a sense, much more practical than that. And at one level, it is, you know, as Sylviane has made very clear, it is absolutely about beginning to recognise, sort of, if you like, take the private into the public arena and to say that the public will only work, women in the workplace, fathers in the workplace, will only work when this boundary between public life and private life is one which is more permeable, you know, characterised by, you know, the women, remember, you know, when our children were younger, how sometimes, you know, when one of them was ill, we would phone to say that we weren't well rather than admitting that our children weren't well, or that, you know, we were not going to a school concert but we were going to the dentist. You know, all these denials of our twin identity. And so I think that the objective of public policy with a number of sort of very specific measures is to sort of reintegrate women, because I think this whole state of living in a split identity is deeply disturbing and distressing and robs you of perhaps one of the most satisfying things that you're ever going to do. And I think that, you know, women are further ahead in this game than men are, but, you know, men are similarly denied that that sense of personal richness and that sense of personal wholeness. And I think that Sylviane is right that we have, in the last 5 years in government, made a lot of progress. And one of the reasons I think that we've made a lot of progress is that, you know, at particular times over the last 5 years, there have been women in positions in government, you know, like Patricia, like me, like Margaret Jay, like Harriet Harman, who have, in a sense, fought for these things, you know, all our lives. And, you know, many of us, like, you know, lots of you, all of us, have lived with this experience of feeling that we just haven't got it quite right, and that for our own children and for other younger women, we would like the combination of work and life to be easier. So, you know, from that, you know, from the experience of knowing that, you know, you go back to work too soon after your baby, you know, comes the, you know, the real sense of motivation to get paid maternity leave, not just 18 weeks paid maternity leave, but, you know, there is all the difference in the world between how you feel after you've had a baby who's 18 weeks old and how you feel when your baby is, you know, 28, 29 years, 6 or 7 months old. The importance of flexibility, the importance of legislation that begins to shape attitudes at work that recognise that the work-life balance is not some sort of middle-class luxury, but it is actually, you know, a fundamental and prerequisite for so many of the bigger social policies, or the big social policies, that our government stands for. You know, strong families in strong communities, and, you know, being able to build lives in balance is, I think, a prerequisite to being able to build strong communities. And paternity leave, and I thought that your example of the embarrassed man was absolutely wonderful. I mean, I remember back in 1978 when I was a councillor in the London Borough of Camden introducing one of the first equal opportunity schemes in the country, and introducing 2 weeks paid paternity leave for men, but it wasn't very often taken, as you rightly say. But even in countries that have got a long tradition, like Sweden, Denmark, of paid paternity leave, the rate of take-up for fathers is very, very low compared to the rate of take-up of maternity leave for mothers. So, I mean, this is, you know, this is a deficit which is much more extensive than just in the than just in the UK. So, maternity pay, paid maternity leave of the right length, childcare, policies for work-life balance, promoting a culture of balance are all ways in which public policy can impact. The national minimum wage, the New Deal for lone parents, the Sure Start programme. The Sure Start programme, which I, with David Blunkett, set up when I was public health minister and he was at he was education secretary, which is all about helping women who are poor, who are in many respects, you know, poor in respect of their own nurture, their own mothering, materially poor, to feel good about being mothers, feel good about themselves as mothers. Because that's the other very important part, isn't it? It's not just about being able to feel competent and confident in the workplace. It's also about feeling competent and confident and engaged as a mother. And how many times do we, you know, do we sort of, you know, as a society, do we trip across the evidence of how we downgrade motherhood by introducing ourselves, you know, at periods when we're not working, as only mothers, or women who introduce themselves, describe themselves as only mothers. So we need to, sort of capture the profound nature of the social change that we need to achieve. Social change that can in part be driven by sort of literal and practical government policy. The sort of policies that mean that support fits itself around the lives of women throughout their years as mothers, but similarly fits that support around the lives of men. But I think that this is another, as in so many of these areas where public policy impacts on private choice, that, you know, government action alone is not going to deal with a lot of the underlying insecurities and ambivalences that Sylviane's research has so graphically highlighted. The sense that, you know, when you're at work, touches on my earlier point, when you're at work, you have a clear definition of yourself. You describe yourself in terms of what it is you do. And the sense of the sense of nervousness, uncertainty that many women have about trusting themselves with the identity, the much more fragile identity of being a mother. So I'm quite clear about what the public policy response needs to be. We've made a start and we need to be able to go much further. I'm less clear about the way in which we reinforce public policy with the kind of culture change, both social and sort of psychological culture change, which is going to begin to challenge the figures that Sylviane has identified, and also is going to begin to challenge the extent of non-participation of fathers in all the kind of opportunities that make it easier for them to enjoy and give time to enjoying being a father. And I suppose the final thing is to say that, you know, everybody, you know, most women want to be mothers, most women want to have children, and what is it you lose if you never have children? And I think that one of the most important, and this is where I think we need to think about how sort of the public and private, you know, interconnect, is that it's probably only in relation to your children that you have the experience of being irreplaceable. And only in the context of your relationship with your children, that you have, if you're lucky, a relationship which is utterly unconditional. And those are wonderful riches in anyone's lives. And I think that Sylviane's work has presented us with a profound challenge, personal and private challenge, but also a challenge to our public policy. Thank you.
Now, we were going to have a chat, but we've only got 20 minutes or so, and there's so many of you, and I can feel the room's bursting with questions. So what we're going to do is I'm just going to talk for long enough for one of you to build up the courage to put your hand up, and then we can get kicking off. And I will start with a question, and then I'll stand up at the podium to sort of see everyone for asking questions. My question is about business. I know how hard you fought, Tessa, in government, and mostly behind the scenes, to try to have a more progressive attitude to this. But one of the things you've had to fight against is the assumption that any better provision for women, or indeed for parents, is a burden on business, is an impediment to profitability, will damage the British economy. And there's a peculiarity here, because most employers that I meet, and I'm usually being polite to them because I have to raise money, but most employers that I meet will talk about their family-friendly policies and how proud they are of them, but yet collectively business, like a sort of unpleasant tribe of schoolboys, will fight. They will fight to the last breath to stop any sort of provision. So this peculiarity between employers who want to talk proudly about their personal provision, their own organised provision, but will fight collectively. What can we do to break that up? Women's CBI?
Well, maybe. I think we need more women in positions of key positions in the CBI, certainly. And I think that the difficulty that we had in getting flexibility in relation to part-time work was a very good illustration of that. A kind of, tremendous apprehension by business. But when you actually look at the practice of individual companies, then the pattern is as Matthew has described. I mean, I think that the second is that those that are progressive in this see it as good for the bottom line and will boast of it as being good for the bottom line. And certainly, what we did when we were working on the childcare and the maternity leave policies was to use those examples, but the problem is there aren't quite enough of them. But there is one last just example I wanted to say to you, which is that in terms of culture change, the chairman of one of our largest public companies, I mean, this was a real joy when we were looking for very, very robust, good and persuasive examples of companies that did recognise work-life balance and family and sort of workplace life, was when he said to a big city seminar, "I recruit women with children because I regard motherhood as the best possible training for project management, and what my company depends on is having good project managers."
Tessa, maybe I could also just tell a story. One of the companies that helped fund this big survey, and I did get some private sector as well as foundation funding because I wanted them to be in on couching some of the solutions, was Ernst & Young. And they have made this huge commitment to reduced hour weeks because they do recognize it's the time crunch that is the heart of the dilemma, for so many women, but also men. There are now 13 varieties of reduced time careers you can pursue at Ernst & Young, which range from, 4/5 weeks to summers at a reduced schedule to part-time partnerships. They just created 35 of them, which is a real acid test. But for me, the test of the corporate culture and whether they were walking the talk, came after September 11th. Because in New York City, this firm saw revenues drop almost 30% because much of their business was in the tri-state area. And they faced a fork in the road. They could either do the usual American thing, which was fire a whole bunch of people, or they could spread the work round and make part-time work available to many more people. they took the second route, the first time ever. The other thing they've done at this firm, and I use it as an example, although it's certainly not the only one out there, they have kind of bitten the bullet in terms of returnees. And in a way, one of the most vivid images coming out of the interviews in the book is this notion of there being a career highway. And the highway has all kinds of off-ramps, but there are no on-ramps. And one of the real challenges out there, since we do have these very long work weeks, is figuring out how to interrupt a career and get back on that highway. Because I found that in the women I surveyed, the highly qualified women who were at home with their children, two-thirds of them were struggling to get back on. And it's almost impossible. Now, you go talk to a private sector leader about this, and they immediately see the logic, because at least in America, fully 25% of women with professional degrees are not in the workplace at all, and yet two-thirds of them would like to get back in. But it's just we have no mechanism for doing that. So at Ernst & Young, the mantra has been, we need this staff to recruit, to retain, and to reattach. And it was that third item, which I think in a way is the most imaginative. And one of the best initiatives here, I think, is the one led by Peter Elwood, the Employers for Work-Life Balance. There's nothing more convincing than having 22 companies out there giving awards for work-life balance, which happened just last month here. So I think slowly the word is spreading, and it is really about well-being. I mean, at least in New York, you now can take your dog to work. You can dress down on Fridays. You have free membership of health clubs. But you still have a struggle on this work-life front. But nothing, obviously, is more fundamental to the confidence, the trust, the well-being of that woman employee who will display this loyalty and productivity over a lifespan if you give her the ability to wind down a little or to quit and reattach. And I think that it's the life cycle that we've, you know, got to now plan for. But there is at least a glimmer, I think, of good news.
Great.
I'm going to stand up now. I'm going to stand up so I can see you, but I want to stand up because I've learned over experience that it's better when people start asking questions that last 20 minutes. It's easy to shut them up when you're standing up, so that's why I'm doing it as well. I've seen a woman there in the blue top.
I just wondered about the impact of the process sometimes described as infantilization or boomerang kids, people not leaving home, and the idea that young people grow up a lot later these days. Because, well, I think you're right, the women don't choose not to have children, ever. It's certainly true that they don't choose to have them in their 30s. And it seems to me that that's not really... That seems to have more to do with the kind of a cultural thing, where in today's society, as Tessa hinted at, it's seen as a very scary thing to be a grown-up, to take responsibility for anything. And the culture of youth really lauds being young and being irresponsible. And there's a final point. I'm not sure if that's susceptible to a public policy response. And I worry that a public policy response often makes things worse, because through bringing in schemes to support parents, or, you know, to kind of, Tessa was hinting at give people confidence, and that tends to reinforce the idea that parenting is really difficult, no one's ever done it properly before, and that you need the government there to tell you what to do and hold your hand. So I do think it's very difficult, and I'd like to know what both speakers think about that.
I'm going to take two or three together, if that's all right. Otherwise, we just won't get around everybody. But thank you for that. There was a woman in the back row. There she is. Could you just wait for the mic?
I wanted to pursue the working hours issue, because in somewhere like Sweden, it's not a matter of voluntary choices by businesses, it's statutory legislation. Right. And we appear to have opted out in a number of ways from the European legislation of the 48-hour working week. We make it very easy for people to opt out of that. And 48 hours a week seems to me a very long time anyway, if you are trying to possibly combine having a career and having children, or just having a job and having children. Also, again, in somewhere like Sweden, it's again a statutory right for women, maybe men, I'm not sure, but with children, to be able to take a three-quarter of a job, and they don't lose their job by doing so. And the position in Britain seems to me perhaps to be made worse by our high house prices, so that two salaries are needed from both people at the, particularly the times of their lives when they're going to be having young children. So it seems to me that we need government policies here. It's not a matter of choices from women and men, and nor is it a matter of businesses being good businesses and making personal business choices.
Okay, thank you. I've got a woman here in grey, and then I'm going to say something I've always wanted to say when chairing a large meeting.
I just wondered if both of you could say something a bit about pay, because that seems to be one of the trickiest options. It's not economically rational to get a man to give up his job in a couple household if he earns more than the woman. And I know we have equal pay legislation, but that's not always how it works out in practice. And that's both for, obviously, lower paid women who are concentrated in part-time work in marginal service sector professions, but that's also true for the kind of women that you're talking about in your book. Even the higher skilled women, who are, by all accounts, very privileged, still quite frequently are less than their male counterparts.
Thank you. I'm now going to say what I'm going to say, which is there a man who'd like to ask a question? But actually, I can see there are two. So,
Yes, I'd like to ask, is it, assuming it's the case that most successful women are graduates, looking at the UK, I'd like to ask the question, isn't this going to get much worse? We have a successful government policy, past governments as well, raising the number of university students going to university. Currently, I think about 15% of women of the women, total number of women of that age in the country who become graduates is about 15%. It shortly will be 50% if we reach our target in 2010 of half the population going to university. So aren't the street lights on green for the problem actually of baby hunger going to rise?
Thank you. And I've got a gentleman in the front row, and then I'm going to bring the panel back.
Thanks. I saw a summary of your book in our leading tabloid, The Times, which said it was all about finding Mr. Right at 28. So I would like to ask, what proportion of the problem is due to stable relationships being formed much later than previously, as compared to delays in getting a baby once the stable relationship is formed? And the underlying idea is that it's much easier to address the second issue of public policy than the first. And also a bit of an add-on on this public policy issue, how are you going to address the stratospheric issue, behavior and the Goldmans and McKinsey's of this world? Because it's all very well creating, you know, mother-friendly public service and sort of middle-ranking careers, but how about the stratosphere? How are you going to address that?
I'm going to ask Sylvia Ann to be as brief as I possibly can so we can take some more questions. But Sylvia Ann. It works, I think.
Well, those are amazingly challenging
are
questions. Let me just do a little scattershot response here. Obviously, I feel that there is at least some individual leverage in these decisions. And let me tell you a story. My stepdaughter turned 30. The week this came out, this book came out in the States. And in all kinds of ways, I think she needed this book like a hole in her head. You know, she was dealing with the usual set of young professional women's challenges. Not only was she holding a job, a full-time job, which seems to use up about 60 hours a week, but she's also going to school in order to get her graduate degree. So if you add up her week, you know, it's huge. She'd also recently broken off a long-term relationship. But having struggled with this book, trying to figure out whether she really needed to read it or not, because she's a very wonderful young person, in the end she did it, I think, to please me. And she called me on the Friday night and she said, I'm just glad that this book came out on my 30th birthday and not my 40th birthday. Because she feels that there is, you know, constructive ways in which she can mold a little the decisions in her life. And she's certainly going to make a bunch of demands in that workplace. Let me kind of cycle back to the international question, which I thought was great. The fact that in Sweden you're entitled to a six-hour day, you know, if you have a child under eight, is an enormously powerful reason for why all of those university graduates in Sweden actually don't end up without children. You know, if we reduce the number of female graduates, you know, we won't get us where we're going. Obviously, we live in a world where all kinds of countries have solved this problem in the sense of allowing more men and women to lead more balanced lives. The other comment I want to make, one of my great joys last week is that Goldman Sachs has approached me to help them with a little internal policy making. There were three companies that popped out of the blue last week. They were Goldman Sachs, Marriott, and McDonald's, with very, very different workforces. But they do understand that having a revolving door of overburdened mothers or young women trying to get themselves a life is not good corporate policy. There is a war for talent out there, and we really need to retain our workers because it costs us a whole lot of money if we have high rates of turnover and attrition. And so it is, you know, this recruit, retain, and reattach business in terms of the logic internally. And I guess what I feel is that we do need both things. I think the self-consciousness, and I want to go back to the first question, and I'll end up with a story. My daughter, who's 24, and my stepdaughter sat me down recently, and we all watched Sex and the City. They felt I had to get a little caught up on, you know, young people's culture. Not that I had never seen it before, but they wanted to watch it with me. The particular episode we watched was when Kerry, at age 34, ends a relationship with her longtime fiancé, Aidan, because she's having this huge debate in her mind as to whether she's ready for commitment. You might all have seen this, I don't know. But, you know, there's the pros and the cons of the freedom as opposed to the constraints, etc. And the culminating scene in the episode is that she goes to a bridal store and tries on a wedding dress and comes out in an allergic rash. I mean, literally. I mean, a huge, you know, series of red bumps across her body. So she thinks her body's telling her something, that she's not ready for marriage. Now, in this whole debate, which took, you know, the entire episode of this show, there was not one word about what was happening with the biological clock or whether this woman thought she might one day want children. It simply was not mentioned. And I felt like, you know, running up to the TV and, you know, knocking on the screen and saying, how about the eggs, you know, or whatever. Because I felt that whatever decision was being made in that episode, it was a disservice to young people that was not on the radar screen. Because for a 34-year-old, it should have been there as an issue to tangle with. Now, I'm not trying to say what the decision should be, but it is something that needs to be thought about at those kinds of ages. So, I mean, I do, you know, understand that we do have a bunch of cultural barriers as well as policy ones.
Thank you. Can I just, before I bring in Tessa, recommend another one of Sylvia Allen's books, which is called The War Against Parents, which she wrote with Cornel West, which is not available in Britain, but you can get it on Amazon, I think. Which is one of the things that book talks about is the way in which the media represents children or doesn't represent children and parents. But it's very interesting. Tessa? Mm.
I'd like to say something just very briefly about the pay gap and reattachment, because I think that taking Sylviane's point about reattachment and the examples from progressive corporate firms, that, I mean, that's where part of the answer to the pay gap lies, because if you look at the development of the pay gap, it starts with women in their 20s and then accelerates from there on. If you have a proper system of, if you like, sort of lifelong career counselling, somebody who is going to help you move in and out of work, because most of us, particularly women, will move in and out of work. Will move in and out of work at different levels. But, you know, if that's managed, then you're much less likely to suffer the grossest effects of the pay gap accelerator in your late 20s and into your 30s. And Marks and Spencer's is a very good, an interesting example here. There was a time when the 30% of women who worked at the biggest Marks and Spencer had been there for, you know, throughout their whole working lives. So what they did was to develop this, you know, program of sort of lifelong career planning. Now, I mean, when I was employment minister, we did a lot of planning of how such a program might work alongside the New Deal for the for lone parents. But the election came and I moved on, and you know, I'm not sure if it still continued. But I think in that is something of an idea. People have an exit interview when they leave big companies, but very rarely does that focus. You know, it's seen as a sort of once and for all. You leave, not that you leave in order then to plan when and at what level and for how many hours a week you may come back.
Okay, now, you're all supposed to be going upstairs to drink warm wine and cold vol au vent, whether maybe it's the other way around, I don't know. But should we take one more round of questions before you do that? Yes, yes, you're all saying yes. Okay, I'm going to arbitrarily pick, there's so many hands, but I'm going to take you first.
I was intrigued by your example of the woman that you spoke to who was at Golden for 11 years and said that as she climbed up the mountain that the air only got thinner. And I'd be quite interested in getting your personal opinion on something and perhaps putting you on the spot a little bit, which is if you had a 28 or 29-year-old daughter who was in a job, say, at Goldman Sachs and doing incredibly well, and in that position it would be very difficult for her to meet Mr. Wright and then go on and have children at the right age, what would your advice to her be? Would you advise her to pursue her career until she perhaps meets Mr. Wright, or would you advise her to consider alternative career paths?
Now, that's a very good question, but I'm going to say that question up and suggest that Sylvia Ann answers that question last, because one of the things I've been the most misunderstanding about in the book is what your actual advice to people is. So let's finish with that one. But I'm also going to take the woman there who's got a pencil in the air. Pen in the air.
Hi, I wanted to bring the question back to single people a little bit. I do an awful lot of work with an online dating company called Match.com, and we talk to singles in the UK who tell us many things, that they get to a point where they're single for many reasons. They say that if they're professional in the UK, and I'm sure it's the same in the US, you tend to be very mobile. You move away from home, so you move away from your social structure of your group of people who traditionally introduce you to other people. Also, you're probably working very, very long hours, so you don't have the time to go out and have access to other people. And you may not want to go out, you know, if you're a professional person in your 30s and go to a bar and find somebody in a smoky haze of alcohol. But the one thing that many people tell us time and time again, and I'm bringing this back to your internal policy making you're being asked to help with, is that their employers, and you know, this is people in the likes of Goldman Sachs and Ernst & Young and other such companies, positively do not like them socialising and having relationships in the workplace. It's positively frowned upon that women and men are actually having open relationships with other work colleagues. So they feel that they cannot have relationships with the only people they're meeting. And I wonder whether you'd consider in your internal policy making of saying to them, you know, let your employees date. Put a position in place where they can meet each other and date in the workplace, because they're the only people they meet. They're very similar people. They're the people they should be having relationships with.
Thank you. We don't even have milkmen anymore, do we? there's a man there. Oh, go on, you can talk loudly. Go on. I know you're a bit hoarse, so you can't.
I'd like to ask the same question about the daughter from Goldman Sachs, but take it a stage further. Supposing she's met Mr. Wright, or someone she likes a lot, but he's not earning very much, and he's terribly interested in childcare. Now, what would your advice to a daughter in that position be? I'd like to ask the people on the panel this, because it's the fundamental question, really. Is when is this when is the male breadwinner role going to change, and how would you go about changing it?
Okay, now there's lots of other people, but I'm not going to take anybody else because we've run out of time, and I'm going to abuse my position by asking the last question, which is, I just want to question your, I'm just afraid it's a very nerdly policy, think tank question, but I'm not sure you're right about the domestic division of labour. I am surprised here that, I know we're terrible in Britain, but I think it's just as bad, isn't it, in southern European countries. And I, the best account I have read of why it is that Spain and Italy have got a lower birth rate overall is because of the gap between the relative equality of the social sphere and the continuing gross inequality of the domestic sphere. Basically, if you're a Spanish or Italian woman, you have to get a Spanish or Italian man to have a child, and Spanish and Italian men are not very reconstructed. Seems to be the most and the best analysis of that demographic trend. And I was just thinking this the other day when there was a remarkable story which I should share with you, which is a man who was a 35-year-old man who took his father to court because his father had refused to carry on paying his mother for his maintenance. He was still 35, he was still living at home, because a huge number of men in Italy in their 30s now live at home with their mothers because they can't find wives to look after them the way they've become used to. And he successfully won the case. He successfully won the case that his father had to continue to pay his mother maintenance even though he was 35. So I think there's perhaps you're being too tough on us British men in comparison to our continental counterparts. I don't know. Anyway, Tessa, I'll go to you first, and then Silviana. Could you finish with these choice questions? Tessa.
What advice would I give to my 28 or 29-year-old daughter? Well, I really don't know what advice I would give. I'm not sure, because I don't think there's a formula. I really don't. And I think advice is quite dangerous. I mean, I think the best thing you can do with your children is to, you know, hope that they're free enough to make decisions and choices that they feel you're going to approve of and help and, you know, support them in. And so if my daughter said, my partner earns less or, you know, really, really wants to stay at home with the baby and so forth, I hope that I would say that was absolutely fine. But I suppose this is the private bit of the relationship between public and private policy that will become the driver of change that I was talking about.
Sorry.
Let me just pick up just some threads. This book, I think, is about the voices of these women and the power of this new real data rather than my opinions. And I think the thrust of the collective wisdom in the book is that you need to be intentional. I mean, one size does not fit all. I absolutely agree with Tessa. But they're definitely coming out of the midlife women is the sense that you need to give this some very careful thought. Not just put it on the back burner, i.e. the family agenda, and assume that you can get to it, you know, much, much later in life. But you need to have it in play earlier, because the fact is you can make much smarter choices if you're in touch with your real options. And don't just pretend, of course, like Gina Davis, you're going to do it when you're 46. Now, I think, and again, I'll use a voice from the book. Her name is Karen McGuire. And these women use their real identities, which was very brave. She works for Payne Webber in New York. She has a 72-hour week. She's a very accomplished, quite lovely young woman. But she said, I know I want two children in the context of marriage. I know I can't have those kids later than 40. And so I do this backward mapping, which leaves me thinking about now. She said, I don't have time to wash my hair in this job, let alone date on Friday night. So I probably need to bag, to use her word, this particular career, if I'm going to put myself in a position to meet the guy that makes all of this happening. About 6 weeks ago, Karen went to work for the government in a field that she can do really interesting work. She took a 2/3 salary cut and a great loss of status. But because she had thought through her values, her happiness, this made sense for her. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not trying to say that that should be anyone else's decision, but intentionality is a good idea, because the fact is that just getting out there and cloning the male competitive model doesn't work for a lot of women, because the constraints and the opportunities facing women on the family front, their family stories remain profoundly different. A final story going to men. I did survey men in this book, And some of those findings are fascinating because it shows how shared the sense of deprivation is in these very market-driven environments. Only 7% of my men in the book felt that they had it all, a very surprising figure. So I went to interview all kinds of these men to find out how come I had that kind of figure. Because as one of the men said, you know, on paper, I look as though I have it all. I'm a biological dad. You know, I have two wonderful young adult daughters. I'm talking about a physician in Oregon who particularly shared his life with me. I have a wife who I've been with for 25 years, and I have a hugely successful career. But he also said, I was so tethered to my profession for 27 years that I barely know my children. I don't even know what kind of music they like or whether they're scared of death. And I don't want that set of, I guess, lack of balances to go down to the next generation. I find that the women, again, their voices, the data around them in the book, understand that they are seeking perhaps a different kind of man out there. Up until now, to use the word of an African-American journalist who I was talking to about this last week, women traditionally have married out and up, men have married out and down, which means that the pool gets larger for men as they, you know, grow a little older, and the reverse is true for women. I discovered the beginnings of a rethinking of that, but we do hit a very profound reality, which is that only 2% of couples that I surveyed, because obviously I'm looking at the entire spectrum here, had house husbands, which is a pretty tiny percentage. And a final point on Matthew's comment. I'm not saying that many countries have a better division of labor at home than we do here or in the States, but what I'm saying is that you need all four factors to be operating to get the very high rates of childlessness that we have in the societies that I talk about in this book. And indeed, in my survey, I snuck in this very mischievous question. I asked women, and this was about their partners or their husbands, do you feel that your spouse or partner creates more work than he contributes at home? I got the most amazing reaction to that question. Now, 10% of women wrote me screeds about how wonderful their partners were. But 43% of women agreed with that statement and wrote on average 3 pages about it. So I think that, you know, it is a huge ongoing challenge, and it is one of those cultural, you know, tied in with policy questions that will continue to puzzle and follow us. In the Swedish case, when they first opened paternity leave to men, only 3% of men took it up. It's now at the 27% level. So over time, if you make it paid, you make it legitimate, and eventually more men start taking it. So again, this is not a night and day situation, but progress can be made.
Thank you very much for those words, Silver. And third words for me to think of when I do as I did yesterday, remove the children's white shirts from the washing machine, slightly pink due to the red sock which I had to put in there. Well, thank you all this evening for what's been a brilliant discussion. You're going to go to the common room on the 5th floor. You're going to come up and have your book signed by Silviane, if that's what you want to do. But can I ask you to thank Tessa Jowell and to thank Silviane Hewlett for what I think has been a really nice